What if I try this new thing and some people just don't like me? My guest this week, Neil Hagberg, voiced these worries of his own many years ago to his then 8-year-old daughter. Her response, which you will love, trust me, set him free to take the risk and opened up his life in ways he could have never imagined. She helped him to realize that if you free yourself up to really be yourself, then you actually become yourself. Across our time together, he shares other stories of hard choices, like letting go of the safe and lucrative path of becoming a doctor in order to become, well, a singer-songwriter, of flaws and failures, of the importance of curiosity, beauty, and imagination in the face of all that's broken in the world. We explore what it means in that kind of world to choose to love anyway. As you'll hear, Neil and I have known each other for 40-some years, since our college days, and we reconnected nearly 20 years ago when I invited him for several years in a row to spend a week with us as artist in residence in a class I was teaching back then called Changing the World, Justice, Action, and the Meaning of Life. He'll tell you about it, so keep listening. And listen, too, as he talks about living in the paradox of it's not as simple as it seems, and it's as simple as that. Neil Hagberg is director of Tennis and Life Camps at Gustavus Adolphus College, which has been recognized as one of the top tennis camps in the country by Tennis Magazine. Neil designed the life portion of Tennis and Life with legendary coach and teacher Steve Wilkinson, who taught a radical, simple approach to winning more matches, take the focus off winning, and who taught both tennis and life skills by focusing on the only things we can control, our attitude, our effort, and our sportsmanship. Neil is a 1981 graduate of Gustavus, received his MDiv at Luther Seminary, and he was also a touring singer-songwriter for 25 years with his life partner Leandra Peake as half of the duo Neil and Leandra. He performed concerts in 45 states and Canada in venues ranging from coffee houses to Carnegie Hall, and is the recipient of 2 McKnight Artist Fellowships, one for performing and one for composing. And as you'll hear, he's incredibly proud to be a dad. I'm Chris Johnson, so grateful that you're choosing to listen to another episode of Pause, Purpose, Possibility, and that you are who you are in and for the world. Thanks for being here and for being you. I am just so incredibly thrilled and honored and grateful that my friend and musician and all-around spectacular human being, Neil Hagberg, is joining me today. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you, Chris. This is great to be here.
I warned Neil, or invited Neil, to be thinking before we pressed record that I like to begin these conversations by having my guests introduce themselves. What is the story that you want people to know about who you are or who you understand yourself to be these days, Neil, in your life and in the world? So run with that one, wherever you'd like to go.
I think that what you said you warned me is a better description than you invited me. Oh, well. Because it's like, who am I? Who am I in the world? I'm just going to go free association.
Good.
Dad is the first thing that came to mind. A spouse came to mind, a musician, a writer, a person who is curious about just the world. And I didn't even realize that I've always been curious about the world. I just have. So curious, stubborn, persistent. I would say in many ways, well, this is going to sound like a really big ego. Well, I have a big ego.
So we're clear.
But kind of, I see big picture things. So I'm terribly scattered with smaller things. I have ADHD, like you would never want to wish on anybody else. And one of the reasons I became a songwriter or writing poems or taking photos instead of being a painter is because of my ADHD, because songs are a small, they're small pieces that I can zero in on and focus in, and I can be in a song for 2 or 3 hours, and you throw a bomb in the room, and I would not know it exploded. So I look at that and I say, "Oh, what a gift! What a gift!"
May I pull on this thread of curiosity a little bit more?
Yes. Yeah.
What is it? What is a thing that is intriguing your piquing your curiosity today, or at this point in your life? What do you find yourself wondering about?
I find myself wondering about the place of beauty in the world and what it does and what it doesn't do. And if it can save us from self-destruction or not. And my belief is that it cannot save us from self-destruction because not enough of us look for it. And I don't think we're going to get there. I don't think we're going to evolve as a species quickly enough to recognize that our imaginations are really what are going to save us. But we have to have a collective imagination. And part of the thing with having lived for 64 years is to realize that I can't control most of it. So,
So,
curiosity.
so whether
Right.
they so whether they would save us or not, I think I'm hearing you say still what the world needs is just more beauty and more curiosity.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. And I will keep it, I will keep the G version or the PG version of having grown to 64 now and knowing what at least I've told Leandra what I want on my tombstone, if I have a tombstone, and it would be, "We are all effed." But there's going to be parentheses, "But I choose to love anyway."
Anyway,
And so it's sort of like, I honestly can't control anybody else, but I can choose in each situation to love. I can, and loving in every situation requires tremendous curiosity and imagination, because you can't imagine another person's situation or the person that hurt you. If you can't imagine the hurt that they have experienced, then there is no way any bridge is going to be built.
So you've named curiosity, imagination, love as important components of who you are and what you want your life to be about in the world. How have those come to be important to you? How have they shown up as threads through your 64 years? How have they manifested themselves in your many, well, decades as a singer, songwriter? How have they manifested in your many decades of association with the Tennis and Life initiative program at Gustavus Adolphus College? How have they manifested in how you show up as parent, as child of your own parents? What have been some of the threads that have run through who you have been and who you've become wearing all those different hats? Where do they come from? Why have they remained important? How have they shown up, manifested themselves in those various kinds of, well, work that you've done in the world?
Let's do it three-pronged: as a parent, as a tennis and life camps director, and as a singer-songwriter. A lot of it, and when you say over the decades, has just been a slow process of unfolding. Because I was encouraged as a kid to, be in choir and do all that stuff, and nobody ever, ever, ever said, "Oh, I think you should be a singer-songwriter for your life." It's like, that's what my parents say. That's what your parents really want you to do. He's like, "I was gonna be a doctor." Okay. It's like, well, that's safe. That is respectable. That's lucrative. Singer-songwriter, unsafe. On the borderline of respectable, maybe. It depends upon, what you're doing, whether it's respectable to people. And then certainly you can, I always like what Utah Phillips said, in when we tend to be in the folk genre, you can't make a killing at folk music, but you can make a living. So, and that is what we did. We were able to cobble together a living because, in some ways, we two things. I had encouragement from the people in the arts in my community, my choir director, my band director, the theater director that I was in a. She had me believing when I played Tevye
In fiddle around the roof.
that I was Broadway bound. Now, and what is beautiful about that is that it was the first time I ever internalized something and went, "Oh, you know what? I'm good at this. I could get better at this." Nobody else had ever said, "Have you ever thought about doing that?" So someone like Bon Johnson, maybe unknowingly to her, set a flame in me that just was like, "Whoa, I want to explore this." And as I began to explore that side of me, which would be the more imaginative, curious, creative side of me, it ran into conflict with the side of me that said, "Be safe, do the thing that your dad did, and make money so you can retire." And then you run into people along the way, and that's where I go, the sparks. And you and I have talked about the Japanese farmer I lived with, but he had been a classical musician trained in Tokyo, and he gave all that up to become a very poor dairy farmer in northern Japan because he wanted to be a dairy farmer, and he wanted to build two schools or houses, one for boys, one for girls, and bring kids out of the city and have an understanding of what the country looks like and everything like that. I mean, he gave up his music so he could do cows. And when I was at one point, we recycled everything while I was there for the fall working with him. And I mean, they had 11 cows, and he didn't have two nickels to rub together. And I was like, "There's no way this guy is ever gonna attain his dream." Spoiler alert, he ended up doing that. Like, it took him about 20 years, but he ended up getting that. But in the meantime, he was so focused on how he could give to others and what he was going to be able to do. But also, he was focused on the creative side of, if you want to try something, well, then try it. And one day when we were dismantling, we hadn't dismantled, he had dismantled this shed that another farmer was throwing away as garbage. And Kawamura looked at it and went, "I can build a shed out of this. I can use this, and I don't have the money to buy anything." He brought it all back, and it was all full of nails. And he had me for an entire day pull nails out of these boards. It was awful work, and I hated it, and I was angry. And I didn't say anything to him. I just swore a lot. And he saw, as he would walk past, how disgruntled I was, and eventually came over to me and said, "Neil, this is an amazing opportunity for you." And I'm going, "Yeah, right. Tell me how that happens." He said, You are pulling nails out of boards for an entire day. This requires no work from your mind, only your hands, which means your mind is free. Use your mind today to go the places your mind needs to go. And during that time was when I came to that understanding that I was not going to be a doctor. I just didn't want to do that. And I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. And I was almost done with college. Like, oh boy. So I ended up bussing tables for a year after college. But this Kawamura-san was one of those people that went in front of me and just said, he didn't say, you should do this, you should do that. He just said, you got a mindless task. Use your hands for the nails. Use your mind to go where it needs to go. And those were the things that I didn't allow myself as a small town Lutheran golden boy to do. It's like you just did what you're supposed to do.
Follow
And
the script.
yeah, and I have spent really my whole life unlearning that script. So then let's go to parenting. And one of the things that I wanted to do as a parent was to give that curiosity and imagination to Madeline. We had just have one child as a little girl from the time she grew up. I'm like, the world is a magical place. What do you want to do in the world? And how do you want to treat people when you see them? And so we would just explore everything. We would make snow forts. We would do painting. We would do, we'd go to the beach because she found out she loves swimming. And I love athletics. I played basketball, football, and tennis all the way through high school and football and college. And I thought, sports is a real creative way of getting into things. So I introduced Madeline to the sports that I loved, which were basketball and tennis, but she didn't like those. We get out and play, and she was like, okay. And I said, well, do you think you'd ever want to go on and do some more of this? No, I mostly just want to play with you, Daddy. And I'm like, okay, great. So you keep going to sport, and go, well, what would you like? What activity? And she ends up loving swimming. And swimming, honest to goodness, is my least favorite activity in the world. I hate it, but she loved it. And so we went to the beach one summer 41 times. And it's like, we'd hop on, you want to go to the beach? Yes. And then what we would do is we'd go under the water and see, and we were like, there's another world underneath the water here. And there were fish swimming around there, little perch and stuff. So we would do contests of, okay, see if you can touch the fish, Madeline. I touch it. And so we'd come up and I touched one, Dad. I touched one. It's like, oh, I got one too. And so, or once when the beach cleared out because there was, oh, you're bringing back memories that I haven't thought about for a long time. The beach cleared out because there was a massive rainstorm coming in. And if there had been lightning with it, we would have cleared out as well, but there wasn't lightning. And it was just a downpour. And so when everybody else got out, we had the whole beach and lake to ourselves. And we went under the water, and you could hear the like machine guns coming up, and you could see the like the bullets of rain go down into the lake. And we're like, oh my gosh. So what I tried to do as a parent was to expose her to as many things of beauty as I could, and also say, you can't do everything in life, but you know what? Try. Do the things that make you feel happy and beautiful. You don't like tennis and basketball? Don't play tennis and basketball. That's me. You want to swim? You swim. So I spent years all the way through. She swam through college in that hot, humid, boring swimming arena and cheered her on. And that was the deal. So it was like, for me, I learned as a parent, like, I want to open the world up to my child, not close it down. I also know that that will cause a certain amount of pain because
In her or in you or both?
in her and in me, because as we began to talk to her about different people, as we began to talk to her about racism, homophobia, religious bias. These are things that I grew up with in my small town as part of the water I swam in. And I was teaching her, hopefully, to swim in a different pool. And so I knew I'd cause suffering in that with her eyes open, she would be the target from other people in my family. And in the town that I grew up in, because that's the way the world is. If you don't look up and if you don't open your eyes and be creative and imagine that there are different ways of loving, well, then you're going to get slammed down. But she was strong enough that she was like, that's all right. And that's how she views the world. Now, did I make mistakes as a parent? Oh, yeah. But I also told her as a parent that when I screwed up, I would say, I'm sorry, every time. And then I would say, but it's really important for you to know that, well, I'm going to screw up. And the thing is, you're going to, when you get to be older, get a therapist. And then you're going to blame me for the things in your life that you didn't get from me as a parent. And I don't want you to have to lie to a therapist and make things up. So I'm giving you this right now as a gift to be able to hand to your therapist. And so now, anytime I would screw up, she would go, that's one for the therapist, Dad. So we had a relationship that was much more open, I think, and being able to say, boy, I screw up a lot. I screw up a lot, Madeline. And I'm sorry that you might be the recipient of that. Most often she wasn't. I mean, it was really rare. But still, even the things that I don't intend, or when she sees in me, and we haven't actually had this discussion. I think, she's 24. We'll probably have this discussion when she's 30, saying something like, well, you weren't all that, Dad. In terms of seeing the things that I believe, but also intimately hearing some of the things I would say about other people, that would not be, it doesn't mesh with my philosophy. And so, you say you be kind to people all the time. And if she hears me, complaining about my mother-in-law or saying something nasty about another human being, well, it's like, oh, wait a minute, there's a little bit of a cognitive dissonance going on here. And so, but I recognize that, that may be a conversation that we have down the road where she go, Dad, why were you like that? And I'll go, because I'm human. So. Now, I didn't get to Tennis and Life camps, and I don't know if you still want to hear about that.
Of course. What do tennis and life have to do with each other? Why are those things woven together, and how are they in the work that you have done for many years now?
Well, Steve Wilkinson started Tennis and Life camps at Gustavus 48 years ago. I worked with him for over 3 decades before I became director, and then he died of cancer. And asked me to become director, which is the only reason I left my music career. And I left it because I believed in what his vision was, which was to take a look at how we treat each other. And then he said, I don't want to start just a tennis camp. He became the winningest coach in college tennis history. And he never talked to his teams about winning. He never talked about playing well because he said, They can't control those two things. If they could control winning, they'd win every time. If they could control playing well, they'd play well every time. So let's throw those out the window and talk about the things they can control, which are positive attitude, which and it's not a Pollyanna thing. It's basically what's an action you do when adversity hits you. What's your next step? That's positive attitude. Because like when he got cancer, he didn't go, "Oh yay, I'm going to be smiling through this." He just said, "Okay, what's my next step?" Well, my next step is I'm going to battle this thing and I'm going to keep teaching as long as I can. So it's like you identify that in full effort. So positive attitude, full effort is, nobody can make you quit but you. And good sportsmanship is the golden rule. How do you treat other people? And if you treat them, someone can cheat you on the court and you always have a choice. You may want to cheat them back, but you always have a choice of maintaining your integrity and playing fair. So, and then how does that translate into our lives? For me, one of the reasons I've been there for my 41 summers, I would take each summer off when I was Leander and I would do our concert tours from September to May. For me, it was about one of the reasons I came back is because I recognize how difficult that is for me. I am an incredibly competitive person, and that is where the worst of me comes out. And I think that I, at my best, go throw myself into challenges that are the things that are the biggest demons in my life. And so this three crowns, positive attitude, full effort, good sportsmanship, is something I've been learning as I go, because it's almost like by putting it in front of you over and over and over, you begin to kind of live into some of that stuff. And then you think before you act then. But for me, it had to be over and over and over. It's a way of, it's something that Barb Wilkinson, Steve's spouse, who started the camps with him, but Steve had all this philosophy. And I love this quote. I will take this forever. And it was recently when I talked to her, I said, people say that at tennis and life camps, we're brainwashing people, into good sportsmanship and be positive towards others and all blah, 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 blah. And Barb said, "Well, everyone's brainwashed. It's just a matter of how you want your brain washed. So this is how we choose. We choose love. We
Wash
choose."
it in clean water or
Yeah.
in sludge.
In sludge. Yeah. And I was like, "Oh my God, that's nobody's ever said that about brainwashing me before." So that is where that takes my curiosity is how do I live into that? And then with a music career, I'm bouncing back now to I wrote a song once called Rich. But that song, I Am Rich, the second line is I have no money. And it's about the fact that I am rich without that money, and I have to let and when I let go of that need, it's when I recognize the richness. Well, I write that because that is one of my greatest demons in life. When I gave up being a doctor, I didn't give up my desire for a lot of money. And I thought money's going to take care of everything. And I know it doesn't, but I work it out in my songs so that I can look back at 64 and go, "Oh my gosh, I would not trade my life for anything, any amount of money from what I've gotten for this richness." But I have to always put it in front of my face, going, "What really is important to you, Neil? What really is important?" Now, when I'm saying this, recognizing I'm 64 and that our financial planner says we need to work till we're 70, there are times I go, "I wish I'd been a doctor." But you know, my life has been so rich.
One of the many things I've loved about your music, your just your way of being in the world over the decades that we've known each other, since college, by the way. One of the many things I've loved about your music and just how you are in the world is, as you just sort of noted, the way in which your presence, your conversations, your music invites people to consider their own stories, to take account of who they are and why they are that way and what matters. And then one of the manifestations of that was the project, It's Not As Simple As It Seems. Talk about invitations to consider, to unlearn habits and patterns of belief and behavior and attitude and so on by exploring hard, murky waters, difficult issues in real life. Can you tell a little bit about the story of where that project came from for you? How, if at all, it continues to live in your life and work and world these days? And then, not as a gotcha question, but I just have to name that I had the real delight of s accidentally stumbling on social media this morning, the post that Leandra, I came across it on her social media. But it was a Neil and Leandra performance from your living room, your family room. I took it. The reason I'm hooking this in here is because the title of it is something like It's As Simple As That.
Oh, that's so good. Leandra said that exact same thing because my project, it's not as simple as it seems. She goes, don't you think it's interesting? You just wrote a song called As Simple As That.
So again, I don't intend to launch that at you as a gotcha, but I'm just really, I again, it's one more way after 40-ish some years that you are intriguing me. You're inviting me into wondering, curiosity, by way of beauty that you bring into the world. It's not as simple as it seems, or it's as simple as that, or it's both and, or right? Make of that into a question as you
Oh
wish.
no, I got it. I got it. Or I mean, I know how the two connect. So It's Not As Simple As It Seems came about. Again, a lot of these things came about in my life accidentally. I mean, they accidentally on purpose, I guess. When you think that something is turning some way and you go, oh, this is not gonna be good. When we decided to have Madeline, I actually thought, because we'd been on the road for 15 years and I'm doing concerts, and we were not planning on stopping, but we also were like, are we gonna have a family or not have a family? It was really hard for us to decide because we knew how difficult it would be and how we would have to switch everything in our career and not know if we would actually be able to make it financially in that we depended upon touring income. So when she was born, I kind of thought, ah, well, there goes the career. And what I didn't know is the whole career would open up in a way that clarified so many things in my life. Because I have been a people pleaser all my life. And when Madeline was born, everything shifted. Leandra and I sat down and went, first of all, how are we going to make a living doing this? Because we can't tour like we've toured before in the same way. We had to reimagine what our career could possibly look like. And we said, all right, we don't know if this is going to work, but from now on, we are only playing for people that we like. And when I mean that, I mean, we're not going to go to any, quote, career furthering gigs that are soul sucking, that might get you more notice in the music world, or that your record company says it's really important for you to be there for this because that person will be there. It was like, Well, you know what? We don't like that person. We don't want to work with that person. When we were younger, before we had Amanda, it was like, oh, get us in front of that person. Please get us in front of that person. We'll do anything.
Right.
And when she was born, it was like, hell no. We're gonna, and even for audiences, we would go, okay, same thing. If there were places or venues that we didn't enjoy working with the people, we're like, even if it was a bigger audience, we're like, no, life's too short. So we decided to do that. And what ended up happening was we cut our concerts in half and made the same amount of income. And if that's not an eye opener, it's like, oh, if you free yourself up to really be yourself and not to grovel at other people's feet because you need their approval, you need whatever, when you free yourself to do that, then you actually become yourself. When Madeline was born, it made me realize I'd always written. People knew us for, old love, our love songs, our family songs. I had always written some that would just like push people a little bit into a thinking mode of social issues or whatever that might be. But when she was born, I was like, if I would die, what do I want Madeline to know? And I started writing all these songs about race and gender and sexuality and religion. And well, and your class was absolutely instrumental in the changing of this. So, and it was before the recording came out where I was so angry in some of these songs that what I wanted to do was poke. And I wanted to say, F you. And you stupid people who believe this way. And what I discovered again in your class, the very first time when I played one of those songs that really skewered conservative Christianity. But when I played it and I asked the class, what did it bring up in them? And the first kid who raised his hand, and I don't remember his name anymore, but I'll never forget what he said. He goes, that's me in that song. And I went, what? And he goes, that's me. I have all of these prejudices, all of these biases. I've been raised to believe this way, and I don't know what to do with it. And it opened up an absolute, it's like my chest opened wide open, and I just went, oh my God, that's me too. I've just traded one bias for another. And now I'm directing it at you. So that moment, I went back and went through every single song and took out every angry reference and put it into a more, putting it into people's laps as a story. So instead of saying one of the lines in that, in the particular song was, she homeschools her children. Well, that's a pretty stock and cliche way of saying, yeah, they're closed in and ignorant and not doing whatever. And I changed that from she homeschools her children to she loves her children. Even while she's glad that John Lennon was shot because he was keep taking people from Christ. It's like, okay, she loves her children. Okay, then you have a tension in there where people have to go, wait a minute, what is that me? In what way is that me? How does this work in my own life? And so it opened up everything. I went back, took out those things, but I was still really scared because I knew this was going to really create waves with our audience. And I knew it would make some people angry. Even though I put it into stories, it would prod them to have to think in a way that none of us are comfortable thinking, and neither am I. So when Madeline was 8, and Leandra said, you got to tell Madeline about this project, and I had been spending so much time worried about it, and I went into her room and I said, Pumpkin, I said, I'm going to be putting out a solo CD. And she goes, I heard you talking to mommy about that. What's in it? And I told her. And these were the things that we talked with her about being normal from the time she was a little kid. And she listened to me say that, and she went, That sounds so cool. And I was like, yeah, but I'm really scared. What are you scared of, Dad? I said, well, if I put this out, I know that some people are not going to like me. And she, without missing a beat, looked at me and she just said, well, you know, Dad, even if you don't put this recording out, some people are still not going to like you. And kabam, there went everything out the window. I went, well, I'm putting this thing out. And so my life has been a 64-year coming out process of being willing to say who I am, to be who I am, and to maybe be afraid of the consequences, but to do it anyway.
What did you say a few moments ago? Something to the effect of, when you free yourself up to be who you are, you can be who you are. Well done.
So I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, that's the part of it that has to do with it's not
Yes.
as simple as it seems.
So
And
now we get
now,
to It's As Simple As That, which is a love song I wrote for Leandra on our anniversary. And It's As Simple As That is all about saying our choices. It's about us saying, you either like me or you don't, you love me or you won't, love me for, you're going to kiss me or you won't, love me forever and there ain't no looking back. It's as simple as that. And so, but it's, the verses are more about how you come to a place of going, oh yeah, there is no perfect someone. It's as simple as that is basically my philosophy in life, which is love. So it's not as simple as it seems, means you take a look at how messy life is. And it's not simple because there's so many different people, different opinions, different experiences, and different traumas. But when it comes right down to it, it's as simple as that, as I choose love. Could I sing a song or would you prefer I not?
Oh, I love it. I love it. Please.
Okay.
Yes.
I was thinking about this song that I wrote, and it kind of goes along, and nobody's ever, I mean, it's never been recorded, brand new. So it would be world premiere.
Oh,
But
cool.
it's called Not Only Mine. And I'm not even going to say who I wrote it for because I could have written it for any of us. But I wrote it for a person who is deeply close to me. Here we go. Wish that you could see how I see you. And love yourself the way that others do. But we'll learn it young and learn it very well. Why are we always hardest on ourselves? Wish that I could wave a magic wand and bring your loved ones home from the beyond. They'd sit you down and tell you the straight truth. Girl, we are all so proud. Sunshine, but not only mine. You make us happy in a world that's crying. You're the one we love till the end of time. You are my sunshine.
into our mirror, into those eyes. See the beauty there and never be surprised. Oh well, we try, we all try. You are my sunshine, not only mine. You make us happy in a world that's crying. You're the one we love until the end. It's the best that we can do to hope that love is bigger than we knew. And maybe those who love us could be right when we see our darkness, they still see our light. My sunshine, not only mine. You make us happy in a world that's crying. You're the one we love till the end of time. You are my sunshine, but not only. You're the one we love to the end of time. You are my sunshine, but not only mine.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One of our practices so far in the young life of this podcast is to try to end each episode with a big question or two or three for folks to take with them to continue to reflect on what they've heard, and maybe a practice or an action step that they can weave into their lives that's somehow rooted in what they've heard in the episode. Given that you are open and curious and creative and so on, I wonder if I could invite you as we wind down to offer what you think might have some sticking power with folks who have eavesdropped on our conversation today. What's a question or two that maybe you yourself are taking with you from this, or something that you would want to weave into your days as a practice to ground you in what this conversation has been about?
The question of my life has always been, and I revisit it over and over and over, is what really matters. It always comes back with different answers, but always it's love, and which is so friggin' cliche, but it is in what form. So what is a specific act of love that you can do today and every day, each day, that doesn't take a lot of time, that can be yours? One of what I do is every morning when I wake up, I will write a note that says, "Good morning, sunshines." And then I will say something about what they mean to me and go, "I love you, Neil, Dad." And then I'll say, "I fed Dobby at 5:30. So that is, to me, an action that I take every day. At Tennis and Life Camps, two times a day, we stop everything. Someone has got a bullhorn over 12 courts and yells out, gratitude minute, everybody drops to the court, lies down, and for 1 minute, it's not a prayer, it's not a meditation, it's what are the thoughts? What are you grateful for right in this moment? And then let your mind go for 1 minute. And then we blow the bullhorn again and go, everybody up, and they get right back to their drill. So that's another thing that's an easy, because I, as an ADHD person, I can't meditate, but I can do a gratitude minute. And then the third thing would be to, and we started this at tennis camp too, just it's sort of similar to what I'm doing with Madeline and Leandra, but it is a legit, it's a little thank you to write like three or four sentences to someone that you love and thanking them for what it is that they've done for you in your life. And we do it with little sheets of paper, and our instructors keep them forever. I keep them. Our campers keep them. They're so beautiful and meaningful. You, if you don't want to send it in the mail, send off a three or four sentence email to someone you haven't heard of. I mean, you have hundreds of people in your life that you could thank. So just start with that, like three or four sentences a day. Those are the actions that I think that bring to me awareness of all the love I have in my life.
There will never be enough minutes in my lifetime to express my gratitude to you, Neil. Everything about you and my life is gift. Thank you for the gift of your time today, for the music, for the way that you show up, for the questions you have, for the convictions you hold, for the curiosity and the beauty that you bring. Thank you, Neil.
You're welcome, and I want to send that right back to you because you've changed my life. It's not as simple as it seems. The last 20 years would never have been the same. My life opened up when I really got to know you and saw the work that you were doing and the desire that you have for people to find themselves and their calling. So, thank you.
Thank you.